Welcome to the How to Hide a Dead Body podcast, brought to you by Adventure Media Digital Advertising. I am one of your hosts, Isaac Rudansky. I'm with Patrick the Great Gilbert and Danielle the Content Queen Immerman, and we're excited to talk about today's topic. It's interesting, it's dynamic, it could get controversial, so let's dive right in. We are very risky with our clients' advertising dollars. Extremely risky. No, I'm just kidding. It reminds me of something we have on our website where I was thinking of, this was years ago, trying to define our values. Well, I think I knew, or we all sort of felt the values, but putting words to the values. And I was thinking about the fundamental responsibility that we have for our clients, which is managing their money. And it's like a really serious responsibility. And I don't think advertising agencies talk in that terms or think in that in those terms, which is we are custodians of money that's yours. It's like it's a serious responsibility. So it's like, well, would we spend your money as if it's yours? And then I was thinking there's a couple problems with that. One is that no, it's just a lie. As much as I'd like to inculcate and communicate a culture of respecting our clients' money, and it's more of an attitude probably that businesses don't pay taxes, people pay taxes, right? A lot of people feel that, oh, we'll just tax businesses. Just tax, I mean, it's a business, just tax it, right? That way people don't have to pay taxes. I was like, no, well, businesses are run by people and people pay taxes. But also it's like, it wouldn't be true. No one's gonna care about your money as much as you do. So it would have been disingenuous to say, we will manage your money as if it was yours, or as if it was ours rather, because we won't. But also that's not even the goal. Like we're not supposed to, you don't want us to manage that dollars as if they were our own. You want us to take certain risks that you wouldn't be able to take. You want us to run test campaigns that don't have a high chance of success, or to test ideas that don't have a high chance. And however chance plays into the creative sphere is not a simple thing, but it's like, we're not supposed to manage your money as if it was our own. Cause like, I would be too scared to spend my money on this. You're too scared to spend your money on this. You say, here, take my money and spend it on that. That's part of hiring an agency. It's not the only, hopefully that's the only reason why you hire an agency. So there's something in where, like, I think it starts not only in our own internal culture of risk, as far as we could talk about that, building the business and investments that we make and my own personal personality. I happen to not think that I think I'm more risk averse in general, but I think I give off the impression that I am more of a risk taker because I tend to act intuitively without much thought. Some might call that stupid. I'd like to call that intuitive without thought, but we could call it whatever you want. It comes down to the same thing. But I think when it comes to actual like fundamental financial risk, I tend to be on the conservative side. I tend to be risk averse. But we'll get into that also. But I think it ultimately starts with not our internal culture. I think it starts with like the actual business we're in, what we're supposed to be doing for our clients, what our clients want. And you have to be willing and you have to have that mindset where there's an inherent risk in advertising. You're spending money on something you do not know if it's going to work. It's psychologically similar to picking a stock as it contrasts to putting money in a savings account. You're prepaying a network, a channel, a billboard, a television company, Spotify, whatever it is, you're committing to a certain amount of money that you do not know at all how that's going to return. You do it with the best type of analysis and you hire the best people, but ultimately it's a risky business that we're in. It's inherently risk. So I think it's interesting topic, risk, because we're in the business of risk. It's what we trade risk on behalf of our clients. We buy risk. We pay for risk with our clients' money. And we charge our clients on top of that for the great honor of acting risky with their money. It's a pretty crazy thing when you boil it down to that. So that's my initial feelings. Patrick, what do you have in your head over there?
What do I have in my head? So beyond the attitude of risk that we bring to campaign management, I think that there's a broader topic about how we run our business based on taking a lot of risk, despite what you described earlier as being generally a risk-averse person. I am also a risk-averse person, as you could probably attest to. I don't like being yelled at. You know, I'm the person that'll sit down on the airline as soon as possible and clip my seatbelt, and you'll wait till the last second And I think that just plays into my like risk averse, not wanting to get yelled at and follow the rules personality. But I think that you can do that at the same time, run a business in the way that you embrace risk on an ongoing basis. I like your comparison saying that what we do is very similar to buying a stock. It's a common principle in investing that the higher the risk, the higher the potential returns of a given investment. There's also an adage that people in investing will sometimes refer to where volatility is the price that you pay for risk. So if you think, okay, well, I want to invest in risky investments because it'll give me the greatest chance of a very, very high outcome. So I want to be pro risk. That's great. You need to be able to stomach volatility in the short term. You know, risk over the course of 10 years is very different than when you're looking at your investment portfolio today that's down 45%. And I think part of what you're saying before, like whether they acknowledge it or not, clients pay their agencies to essentially stomach that risk and be able to make more rational decisions given a world of volatility as it relates to risk. And in the same way that, you know, a client might make an irrational decision and choose to pull down a campaign in that volatile stage where it needs time to grow, instead of doing that, they might just, you know, send us an email saying that they're freaking out and blame us for short-term performance. And that's fine. And I think that's part of what goes back to what clients pay for. They pay for somebody else to take that risk. But even beyond that, right, I think there's a larger component here about how we operate, how we make decisions. This conversation, you alluded to it, that it was a couple of years ago that you were trying to yourself quantify or really articulate principles. And it came down to, we had this conversation based on hiring principles. We were trying to figure out how can we hire a little bit more effectively and what sort of traits do we really look for up and above just like, I think this person's smart, I think they'd be a good employee. What sort of principles, and that came into actually taking risks on employees. And then that came a little bit broader in terms of risk of office space and other things that have kind of transpired over the last couple of years.
Going back to the client thing, I think it's interesting. I sort of have always been, like when I talk to prospects, and especially in the early days of a client, I think we've all done this, is like you develop an understanding of their risk profile. Like what sort of attitude does the client have towards risk? And it makes a big impact, probably more of an impact than we've ever articulated on how we manage clients. Like clients that have a much greater risk profile, where they're typically larger businesses, typically people who our point of contact, it's not their business. Those are the ones where we seem to have greater capacity to test and expand. And it's not necessarily the individual's risk, own personal risk profile, it's the overall risk profile in the relationship. And it makes a big impact. So it pays, if you're listening and you're a client hiring an agency, it pays to think about your risk profile. It pays to think about how you're going to communicate, because your gut reaction might be to communicate how tight money is and how you need performance right away and how you're going to sort of shackle your agency with fear. And when you shackle your agency with fear, you're guaranteed to get bad work. And you're almost guaranteeing to not have anything good as a product of your relationship with your agency. The best thing you could do, it reminds me of what Ogilvy said, is when he writes a letter to clients, he's like, if you're going to hire an agency, don't negotiate their retainer. Pay them 10% on top of what they quote you. And it's easy to say, well, of course, Ogilvy's saying that, he's the owner of an agency. But if you know Ogilvy, he's not just saying that because he's the owner of an agency. He believes it. Because when you emancipate an agency from fear of being fired because of some sort of short-term performance objective, you get much better work. You get a better relationship, you get more creative work, you get better tests, and you get more mileage for your money over the long term, for sure. There's no question about it.
I actually disagree with your point earlier about the non-business owner being able to take more or being willing to take more risks. I've seen a lot of the opposite, where the business owner themselves, if we're working directly with a point of contact who owns the business, I think that inherently to be an entrepreneur, you take a lot of risk and you're just okay with that and you're okay to jump right in. And I think that's somebody that's a cog in a machine. I guess that's not probably the polite way to say it, but if we're dealing with somebody who's you know, say a marketing executive at a larger company, Fortune 50 company or whatever, they're probably more risk averse because they're more concerned about their own job and not ruffling feathers than they are on really moving the needle with overall business performance, because those are really two different things. It's like the individual career risk, the risk that's needed to move the needle and make gains for the overall business. Now, obviously, there's examples of both.
There probably are no clean buckets to put people in. You oftentimes get surprised by people's, like, take a client that I'm thinking of, that it was his business. And speaking to him on the phone about ideas, you would think he was like the most impossible person to work with, zero capacity for risk, will not spend a penny. And then he'll go and he'll be like, here's $500,000 for LinkedIn. Let's see what we could do. Like over a croissant and a Starbucks coffee. Remain open to learning about people, separate idea, separate topic of discussion. But yeah, I think you tend to get surprised by people's own risk profile and what they're willing to do. And there are so many things, like you said, that go into it. There's financial risk, there's career level risk. There's also the individual's perspectives on the potential upside and potential downside of any given decision, which the degrees of volatility impact risk. Because it's like, if I have an expected really positive outcome and the negative outcome is relatively small, then a person will be more likely to take that risk. If the potential downside is very severe and the maximum potential upside is very small, a smart person would probably be risk averse in that case. So there's many variables that impact
that. To your point earlier about the client risk profile and communicating that to an agency, I think the same thing exists with a manager communicating that to the employees that they manage. I want to go back into kind of defining this whole concept, because we've talked a lot about risk so far. Or I guess maybe even before we turn this on, we were kind of throwing some ideas around. And a lot of people brag about risk and a lot of people brag about failure. They say, oh, you're encouraged to fail and this and that. But like ultimately, that's sort of a platitude. That's like, okay, yeah, but at some point you need to learn something and get better. So what's been your own experience in learning about this concept of risk and how that shapes the way that you make decisions today?
I agree with you. It's just totally a platitude. It's like, oh yeah, like be proud of your failures. No, why the hell should you be proud of your failures? I would 10 times out of 10 times choose not to have failed if I could have succeeded. Totally. It just happens to be that like you're going to fail. It doesn't sound exciting, but like it's just like you need to become okay with failing and not become too discouraged. Yeah, the whole idea of glorifying failure and being proud of failures, it's like, anyhow, what I realized was, let's separate this for a second. So you have financial risk, right? And like when we think about, I think a lot of people, especially in the business world, when you think about risk, you think about it tied to financial outcomes. So am I going to bet $20,000 on this investment, this stock, you know, having a great IPO, which, you know, happens 30% of the time? I have reason to believe that it will. I have reason to believe that this will be a good IPO. But if it doesn't go well, I lose my entire principal. I'm out 20 grand. So that's a very clearly defined typical case of risk. It's like, if I'm wrong, I lose it all. If I'm right, I have a tremendous amount to gain. So in business, risks are usually much more nuanced and they are present in almost every decision you make. Am I going to extend a job offer to this candidate? Am I going to do some office construction? Am I going to give this feedback, even though it's really uncomfortable for me to be critical in this situation? Am I going to take a good process that's working for us and try to improve it, even though the improvements might actually be a step back? They might be a detriment to the process. Like maybe I should just leave well enough alone. Am I going to buy a building? Are we going to rent an office space? Like really, am I going to record a course and be out of the office for 3 months and risk alienating myself from my employees and, you know, morale going down? Every decision you make in business, I think there's some risk, because by virtue of it being a decision, you have two different outcomes that are not entirely clear. Like if you have an obvious outcome, like I need to eat breakfast, yeah, it's a decision, but it's like an obvious outcome. Otherwise, I'm starving and irritable and I die. So it's not really risk. It's not really like you've made a, it's not some decision. It's like, okay, I'm going to eat breakfast. But any decision you're making where it's like, it's not entirely clear which way is better. And if you have a shred of humility, if you have a shred of self-awareness, you'll realize that any decision in business you have to make, it is not entirely clear. If you think that everything is entirely clear, there's something wrong with your head. So what I realized was over time, it's that like looking back at our good decisions was that the decisions where we had, let's say, called that positive return, where the decision played out favorably on the favorable side of the equation, it continued to produce favorable outcomes over time. It continued to ripple outwards into new areas of goodness. It's like, I wasn't sure if I should hire this employee. I have, I have like in the cons column, I have a few things. In the pros column, I have a few things. There's all whatever. And I was like, okay, so I take the bet on hiring the employee. And then that person becomes an integral member of the team. And then they go on to do amazing things in the industry. And they bring in new employees. And they bring accolades and positive, help the company develop a positive reputation. And they're a friend. And they're there for you. It's like it just keeps giving. The favorable outcome of a good decision tends to keep giving. I saw that as a pattern. It's like we're going to go in the building, or we're going to do this, we're going to do that. It's like there's a pattern of it continuing to pay dividends. So, but I think we don't consciously orient ourselves towards the initial decision with that framework. And on the flip side, bad decisions typically what I call are cauterized. Like it's like a wound which is bleeding, 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 but then you sear it with something hot and the bleeding stops. So it hurts. You might be missing a pinky. You might be missing some piece of yourself. And of course, in business, it's not like a body where you have, you know, your business tends to be more resilient to wounds. It's unlikely. I'm sure that people are going to be like, oh yeah, but you can make one really bad decision that ruins your business. Yeah, I know you can. Very good. It's true. You can make bad decisions that ruin your entire business. We could all agree. But most decisions are not the types of decisions that if you're wrong, if you make a bad bet, they're going to totally ruin your business. Most failures are cauterized. And I've had probably more failures than good decisions or bad. I don't know. Maybe it's 50-50. I don't know for sure. But once a couple years ago, I counted like, I don't know, it was $300,000 worth of bad decisions I made in 18-month thing with like a couple really bad hires, a couple of bad programs we invested in, bad decisions, like missed opportunities, whatever. And it's like, we're still here. Now, of course, would it have been better if I had only made good decisions? Yeah, well, we'd all be better if we only make good decisions, but we can't. And what happens is if you're too afraid to fail, you would become an indecisive person. And there's nothing worse than an indecisive, well, there are worse things than an indecisive person, but an indecisive person in business is a really bad character trait to have because you have to know how to make decisions. It's a real handicap to not be able to make a decision, to overanalyzing something to the point where the opportunity has now passed or you're stunting your growth and you cannot move forward and you cannot decide. It's a serious handicap, especially as we're in client services, because ultimately the client needs you to do the work. So you're looking at a Google Ads campaign. There's like, I don't know, there's like 300 different things I could do here, but you need to decide. You got to decide. You got to work. You got to get things done. You got to move forward.
I think just talking that out is extremely helpful. And then it's like, okay, how do we put this into practice? How do we then make that call on whether or not, because that doesn't necessarily mean that you should hire every single person that applies for your company. It doesn't mean that you should just automatically put an extension on the building for the office space. So there's this concept that it really you've coined, at least in my world, of it's not necessarily idiotic optimism, it's more determined optimism. Well, you'll look at a scenario, a decision, so to speak, and weigh all of the different outcomes and evaluate the pros and cons and basically be determined that you're going to see through it to make those pros really shine, where you're going to look at, let's say it's a candidate and they have, you know, three primary skills and three primary weaknesses, that you're going to be so certain that those three primary skills, the strengths, are going to be so significantly better than any downside that'll come with the weaknesses, that it'll work itself out in that favor. And you will set your mind on that and go to it until, if it eventually fails, it goes the other way. But there's that same concept, and you have to basically embrace that idea of determined optimism in a given outcome in an area where there's a lot of risk, there's a lot of potential where something could fail, and be able to see through, and also being able to cut your losses, as we've experienced a couple times. But what is, on a specific note,
that's a skill, by the way. Cutting your losses is definitely, it's a skill that needs to be developed. You can't successfully put into place a framework of determined optimism if you're also not aware of your natural incapacity or unwillingness to cut losses. Because cutting losses could be very uncomfortable, whether it's financial. We see this all the time. Look, you know, this is the typical gambling shortfall. people continue to throw, smart people, good people, very sophisticated people will continue to throw good money after bad, because the recognition of loss and moving on is very, very psychologically difficult. And it's been for myself too. It's been for us. It's very difficult. It's very difficult. And then when it comes to humans, cutting losses as far as employees and as far as the team and as far as clients, it's very difficult.
Walk through the process of the building. The decision was made to invest in buying a building that had tenants and a few other things that we can grow into over time. So you had determined optimism that not only would the company continue to do well, but would continue to grow and need a larger space, not just in 2020, 21, but far beyond that. And then the world got completely shaken up this past year, and there's a lot of companies that have since gone remote and punted on offices altogether. You've kind of doubled down on this concept. And not only, as we kind of talk about in the previous podcast about our journey with COVID and the lockdowns and how we've handled that whole situation, but not only we were able to come back into the office with restrictions starting in June of 2020, that we started hiring more team members, again, embracing more risk when a lot of people in the world, especially in the advertising industry, are laying people off. And also, I think with this, not only were we hiring more team members, but we were hiring more team members at a greater rate than we were signing or growing our existing client base. So we're over just in the last couple of months, we're bringing on new team members or making, you know, the determined optimistic bet that we're going to continue to grow and sign more clients in the short term. This isn't even a long-term horizon. We're saying before the end of 2020, the revenue is going to make all this worth it. But in addition to growing the team, you made the call to shut down the office for about a month so that we can put a massive construction project underway. So there's this constant evolution of risk, work your ass off to make sure that the risk works out in your favor, and then take on the next risk and invest further into it to ensure that you're keeping going that direction. And I'm sure it's a lot to handle, but yeah, what was that whole decision process like for you?
You bring up a few very interesting points. So going back to a year and a half ago or whatever, a little over a year ago when we decided to buy the building. So that was a time when we were doing pretty well. We felt like we needed more office space, so we were growing. And somebody extremely risk averse probably wouldn't be running a business to begin with, but also somebody extremely risk averse would maybe put a few more people into our old office space or rent. And I think that at the time I was open to renting. I was open to buying if there was something which was reasonable. It happens to be that the rental market around here for what we needed would have been difficult. Like for us to have rented a space, our rent would be $12,000-$13,000 a month for what we needed. And like I just felt in my mind, I was like, I don't want to pay $12,000-$13,000 a month in rent. That's a lot of money to pay in rent. If I could figure it out with good, you know, the mortgage rates were pretty good and getting a small down payment together and whatever it was, and we found a thing. So then we found this building. But the real thing was like, okay, so in my mind, it's one thing to be in your mind open to buying. It's another thing to like actually pull a trigger on a building. We came to see this building. It was far from ideal, right? It was like, there were some, again, it was like a pros and cons thing. It was in a good location. It had parking. It had enough space. The configuration was weird. It had tenants, which had its own set of pluses and minuses. Tenants were all lawyers, which is, you typically don't want lawyers as tenants when you own a building. Really, it's like a known thing. A few people told me, it's like, do not buy a building with lawyers as tenants. It happens to be, they're literally the greatest people. So we ended up getting very lucky with that. And it's at that point when this idea of like determined optimism begins to kick in. It's like, listen, what am I going to do now? I'm going to start looking around the entire tri-state area for a building. I'm going to go and evaluate and find something perfect. There's no perfect. There's no scenario where you're going to have just an overwhelming amount of pros. That's another thing. Like there's also a recognition that there is no perfect. To me, I would rather move on and do the next thing in a 20%, 30% gradation above where I currently am than just waiting around to find something which is an 80% improvement or a 100% improvement. Because two reasons. One is I'm impatient. Two, I don't think you're going to find that. All right. I don't see any reason to believe a person will find those situations or opportunities, which is why you see a lot of people struggle and sort of are stagnate. Some people aren't ambitious, and that's fine. Other people are, but they're indecisive and they're waiting for something perfect, and that perfect thing never comes. So it was more in line with my personality. And then I was like, okay, so now once I sort of have that framework and I've decided to do something, you're right. Like I get extremely obsessive about making it work. I become extremely, extremely stubborn and almost unpleasantly stubborn about making something work, which is why it's also hard for me sometimes to cut the losses when the writing is on the wall, which is like, well, this was one of your failures. This is a bad decision. It works both ways. So then we move into the building. And then a few months later, the global pandemic hit, coronavirus. I am 100% certain if coronavirus had hit 2 months prior, I would not have went through with the building because it introduced an enormous amount of uncertainty. But because I had already made that decision, I am now even more motivated and even more intensely focused on making this work, on figuring out a way to make it work. And we have, and we did, and throughout that whole process, while we were remote, we spoke about the idea of the loans, and we spoke about taking care of all of our employees, and we talked about how much we took care of our clients and the focus on running our business economically. And I was going through all of our software. Like, when business is going well, you have software subscriptions that you've canceled, but you're still getting charged for, but like, you're not focused on that. So like, I spent days going through credit card statements, canceling $19 here, $9 a month there, $29 a month here, $100 a month here. I've been paying for Crazy Act for 3 years. So I canceled that, $108 a month. So whatever it is, it's like you shift focus, but it was still a severe determination to make it work. And then we came back and, oh, so here's the thing interesting with the hiring. It was at a time where we were signing new clients, where I found a recruiter who I prepaid the money. So this is sort of the trigger of determined optimism. And it's tricky. It's very hard to find the balance, but I prepaid for 6 hires, the recruiter, because usually if you hire a recruiter, you pay per hire. It's more expensive. I was negotiating the price of the recruiter. I said, I'll prepay you to guarantee me 6 hires. And we negotiated a deal. And then she started sending candidates. And at the time, I felt like we're in a position to hire. We need a larger team. Like, we're growing. And even though economically we were hiring and increasing our payroll expenses at a greater rate than which we were increasing our revenues. And of course, we're not beholden to any sort of investors, or we're not beholden to the market or anything like that. So we could do whatever the hell we want. We were increasing our expenses at a greater rate than we were increasing revenue. I felt that, again, it was, and this is the determined optimism outlook. It's like, really good people. See, there's this concept, Patrick, that we also spoke about, of like override variables that should shut down your decision making immediately. So for example, an override variable is that you don't have money to make your payroll. Okay. You don't have the money. So as great as this person is, as many pros as you have, as much as idiotic optimism as you have, as much as you realize that failures are quarterized, you can't pay the damn bill. So that's an override. No money. So it's override. So to me, it's like we're going through COVID. The advertising industry is on its head. But I didn't feel, and maybe this was somewhat of a function of determined optimism, or I convinced myself, or I focused on this maybe, is that we are still a highly talented agency. We still do very good work. We're still paying our bills. And I believe that we're going to continue to sign clients when we're on the other side of this thing. I believe that nothing fundamental in the machinery or the mechanics of our business has changed to make me think I should pass up on extraordinarily good hires or candidates. And it's possible, if I hadn't prepaid that recruiter, I probably would have told the recruiter, let's hold off, let's take a break. We're not going to start hiring, you know, in the pandemic. But I made the decision. I want to see it through. I want it to work. I'm stubbornly going to see it work. And I think that I think I was right. I think there wasn't any fundamental problems in our business. And okay, so we have less profit for a few months. What's the big deal? I feel strongly that we're still a good agency. We're still a good team, and it's going to work. And yeah, if I could sit down here and tell you for an hour straight of all the ways that it's not going to work and all the ways that these decisions were bad. But like, again, the whole framework of determined optimism is not only that you think optimistically at the time of the decision, you have to continue to think optimistically and even increase the intensity of your optimistic feelings post-decision. And then here's another, I guess the last follow through is like, we have one of our three tenants in the back of the office. He's the one who is most adjacent to our main workspace. And I was talking, like, this was like a couple months ago, we were saying like, I don't know, should we renew his lease? Maybe we should take over the space. And then I was speaking with Frady, and Frady is like, of course, she's like much more risk averse than I am. And she's like, well, that's $2,500 a month in revenue. Like, you need that right now. You're in no position to not be renewing tenant leases. So I didn't not renew his lease, but he came over to me in the beginning of August or the end of August. He says, I'm leaving. He says, COVID has killed my practice and we're downsizing and I'm leaving. And I said, well, okay. Well, that, in a way it was a relief because like sort of the decision was made for me. And then the question was, should we replace the tenant or expand the office? And then it's easier for me because then it's like, it's one thing if you're going to take money you have and hand it back to the person giving it to you. It's another thing saying I could go look for more money or I could look for a tenant or I could go along with this plan of expanding the office. And it was along the same lines as I felt that we were a growing company. I felt that fundamentally we still have a good business. I feel like fundamentally digital advertising and advertising in general is not going anywhere. And here's a chance to make our office really beautiful. Here's a chance to increase our workspace. Here's a chance. And that doesn't mean that you go and do it stupidly. So I went but I had the idea in my mind and there's no shaking it from me. Like there's like, once I'm like, we're going to do it, we're going to do it. And then just fast forward 2 weeks, I'm like 2 weeks into this project. Like I've been like, I can't believe I did this. I can't believe it. Like my office is covered in dust. I can't work. Like this is delayed. It's insane. We didn't need it. And those thoughts are all natural to have, but of course, once we're actually on the other side of this, I'll be happy. But it was like, let's do it. Let's make this happen. And then you still have to do things responsibly. Like I still got quotes from four or five different contractors. The fifth contractor who gave me an expensive quote, I was so fed up with. I said, this is ridiculous. I don't understand how you're getting your prices. You're telling me it's going to be costing me $35,000, $40,000. I don't see how it's going to cost more than $11,000. And we basically negotiated down closer to mine than to his original number, in fact. And we're going through it. And then my last point on this, because I want to ask you how you sort of communicate this culture of risk to the rest of the team. But when it comes to this idea of risk, it translates into many different, you have to walk the walk. You can't just talk the talk. And you have to, it has to be authentic. And it reminds me of recently, this is just this past week, we got a 30-day notice from a client. And the client says, we're basically firing you after the month. It's been a dumpster fire. It has been. Like the client didn't say this. The client just said, like, the client didn't need, let's just put it this way. The client didn't need to say why he was giving us the 30-day notice. There was many drop balls on our end. We made lots of mistakes. The client was difficult. There was a lot of miscommunications throughout the initial 6 or 8 weeks that the client's been a client. It was a very, very rough start all around. And it happens. So the client sent a 30-day notice. So I turned around and I said, you know, sometimes you lose a client right away. We don't want anything to do with you. But the client said, listen, if you guys knock it out of the park, he's not a bad guy. He doesn't think we're bad. It just felt it wasn't a fit. So I sent an email to the lead on the account and the account supervisor, the business analyst on the account and I said, listen, I said, you have 30 days. I first said, like, I'm not upset. There was plenty of miscommunications there. And this is, I'm not playing the fault game right now. That could be a separate conversation. All I'm saying is that your value to me, and I'm talking to my team, your value to me is not reflective of one client being here or not being here. You guys, to me, I see nothing different in you than the day I hired you, which is I see intelligent, sophisticated, good people who I love to be around, who produce good work. And that hasn't changed because this client is sending a 30-day notice after some mistakes were made. That doesn't change. But now is an opportunity. Show boldness. Take risks. Do an idea that's crazy. You've been emancipated from the fear of being fired. We've been fired and we have 30 days. So you have nothing to lose. I said, if we're going to get fired, we should go out with a bold idea. We should go out with a bold campaign. We should go out with a real strategy, something that we would have presented or maybe we wouldn't have presented if we thought the client would laugh at it or wouldn't like it. The worst thing that could happen is to be fired lamely, is to be fired without trying something sincere and strong and courageous. And that's how I feel. Like, I think that plays into this idea of risk taking, especially why we get hired for our clients, is to come up with the creative strategies that other people or other agencies or the clients themselves wouldn't think of and wouldn't want to take that risk. And in a way, I saw it as an opportunity that we've been emancipated from the fear of being fired. So there's no harm in presenting an idea to the client now that there's a fear of the client reaction being, that's the stupidest idea I've ever heard. And in fact, what I really believe is that we should always, an account manager, an agency should always be emancipated from that fear. An agency, whether they're being paid by the client or they have a good relationship, they should always try to structure the relationships with the clients that they are comfortable and willing to voice ideas, even if those ideas might be scorned, because those are the seeds of ideas that turn into really good, really effective, really successful ideas and campaigns. But that starts at the top. That starts with myself and that starts with Patrick, really communicating to the team that you're not going to be fired, you're not going to be looked down upon, and the esteem will not be lowered if you are scorned by a client because they didn't like your idea. Anyway, but I was going to ask Patrick, and maybe we could see this out to the end, because I think this was a good discussion, but you talk to the team every day. The team is working on all different sorts of projects, and especially the team is working at projects that are all at different stages of a client relationship. Some are at the very beginning. Some we've worked with a client for years. Sometimes things are rocky. Sometimes things are great. So how do you communicate to the team that it's okay to fail? It's and encouraging them to voice their opinions, even if these opinions, when they're in their head, seem a little crazy.
It was really hard for me to be able to start doing this. This was some of the feedback that you've given to me over the years as far as things that I need to work on as a manager. But I am a bit neurotic, and I could be a perfectionist at times, and I like things done a certain way. And that often conflicts with this idea of being able to embrace risk and encourage this with the team. That means if you're on a phone call with another team member, a more junior team member, and things are going poorly and they're making mistakes, you need to shut up and let it happen. You know, if they're talking, if they're just saying all the wrong things and whatever, we've seen this happen a million times, you need to sit there and just let it happen. And I used to jump in. Like, this is, you know, a couple of years ago when we started growing the team, I used to, at the first sign of trouble, I would jump in and try to save a call. And it was something that I enjoyed doing because there's something weird and fun about it that I enjoy kind of jumping in, like, you know, whatever. And then I had to sit back and just let the fire play out and then let the call end and then deliver the feedback. And I think that's the only way that people can get good at their jobs. That's the only, especially in this environment that we've created, is you need to let the worst happen. Now, especially on a client phone call, because this is a little bit different than, like, if I see that somebody input the wrong variables into a budget and they're accidentally going to spend more than the client allocated. That's something that, of course, I would step in and obviously talk about before it goes live. But for something else, if it's just you're doing a bad job delivering this presentation, or you're giving incorrect information, and I know that it can be corrected later on with very, very little repercussions, again, to your point earlier about failures can be cauterized, then you have to let it happen. And you take those notes and you need to be extremely thorough with your feedback. And there's a lot of materials that I've had to learn. There's a lot of books that I had to read about how to do this well. Whether or not I do it well, I don't know. But I've read a lot of books that have hopefully taught me how to do it well. So I think that's the first case, is being able to let it happen, for me to be able to sit there and let those things happen. The second part of it, though, is in order to have a culture that embraces risk, there comes with a threshold of excellence that needs to be enforced throughout the entire organization. And I think, you know, this goes back to, like, the Vince Lombardi quote of practicing excellence and making it a habit. And that's something that I kind of picked up on. Like, honestly, like, I got that from, like, high school sports. I just had this, like, crazy high school coach that, like, just embedded a lot of those things that I'm, like, scarred for life about. But it's just the idea of, like, attention to detail and not having a typo in an email ever. Not sending out an invite for a calendar invite that doesn't have the Google Hangout credentials or the Zoom link involved. Or just all of these little things that, you know, things go wrong and you can overlook it. Hey, you know, see the attached report. Oops, I forgot to attach the report. You know, the client or the other person, the other line has to point that out. In my world, none of that shit can fly. I don't stand for it. It's these small things that other people let go. And I don't, because you have to have a threshold of excellence. We are never going to make those sorts of mistakes. And therefore, now we can embrace risk. Now you can go out and make all the mistakes you want, theoretically speaking, because we've set the bar at a certain level, and it's sort of like a military concept. And honestly, the best example of this is we spoke about the ICC before, but Eric, the former a former client of ours, the president of this culinary school, and this guy, he didn't come from a military background. He was just very by the book, and we met with him a couple times and he was extremely thorough. And we took a tour of the facility and he walked around. And first of all, this guy knew everybody's name. He's the kind of person that blows you away because you meet him once, he remembers your name forever. And that's something I've always admired. But we walked in and he would look at a class taking place. And he would just in a second be able to point out that person's dressed, you know, their apron needs to be, you know, 45 degrees this way. That person's wearing shoes that aren't compliant. This person's knives are laid out incorrectly. The teacher should be doing this, that. And he just held a certain level of excellence and therefore allowed everyone else to kind of, you empower the rest of the team and then they can put their personal spin on it. But I think that's kind of the way that you have to communicate out to the team is, look, I expect a very, very high level from everybody. And these certain things are acceptable and these are not. And then once you get the baseline down, then you can make all the mistakes you want and you can learn from your failures.
I totally relate to that. I think that the threshold of excellence is totally a prerequisite. It's a good prerequisite to set. Because you could run a company that has no threshold of excellence and everyone runs around like baboons shouting out stupid ideas to clients. But it's really true that when you produce excellent work and the client could tell that you're a first class person as a first class thinker and you're meticulous and you care about what passes past your desk, then the stupid ideas you bring up are not treated stupidly. The crazy things you say are not treated crazily. They're treated in a totally different light, which I think is why, like you're saying, it's so important to have that threshold of excellence, because not only is it important to produce good work, and I feel that very much so as a value, is like we like to hire, when we talk about integrity, it's like whether or not you're working on a large client or a small client, you care about the quality of your work. Like that, to me, that's part of integrity. And it's important from that perspective, for that consideration, you just want to produce good work. But also when this little things you do are excellent, when your emails are grammatically correct, when your thoughts are coherent, it buys you the esteem to say the crazy ideas and not to be taken for a crazy exactly. person, but to be taken as a smart person with a crazy idea. It's okay to be seen as idiosyncratic, to be a little strange, be a little weird. Those are good. You don't want to be seen as crazy, but you want to be able to say crazy things and have crazy ideas and present them and for them to be, you know, taken seriously. I think that's good. I think we covered some interesting ideas here, and there's a lot more to say on the topic. Danielle, what do you say?
Lots of ideas and thoughts floating in my mind. I think this has certainly been informative for me. Something I struggle with is definitely making decisions and getting past over analysis. I think I'd like to think I'm better taking risks than I am, but it's a slippery slope to get on board with. So maybe in the episode description, we'll leave a step-by-step guide for taking risk if you're a beginner and making better, easier decisions faster.
But Danielle, even joining us was a big risk. You know, like you had your, you know, version of your career mapped out, and this was, you know, being in a ragtag, you know, group of ne'er-do-wells trying to rub a couple shekels together was not in your roadmap, and it was a risk. Like, you have to give yourself credit where credit's due.
That's true. Too right you are. I think we are hard on ourselves unnecessarily in life, and everything that you do inherently contains risk. So maybe a different way of looking at it is just move through life with the idea that everything that you do will lead to something bigger or something failed that will in turn teach you a lesson that is bigger than anything you've done before. So
I like that.
Yeah, I think I could get behind that.
Thank you guys for listening to the How to Hide a Dead Body podcast. Patrick Gilbert and Danielle Emmerman. We will see you and speak to you on the next episode.